Ladies and gentlemen, if you might take your seats, please. We'll let the fire engines pass. Welcome to the banquet and the final event of this year's conference for the Association for Recorded Sound Collections.
Louder!
Louder! Okay, I can be louder. We might need the PA system to be turned up if it's not loud enough for everybody. Okay, no feedback yet. Can you hear me at this level? Okay. My name is Mike Beal, and as most of you know, I am the new incoming president of the association. I just thought I might mention that, because one of the things that I do want to do once again, those of you who were at the business meeting yesterday know that Mike Gray was taken ill and had to go back to Washington, and so unfortunately he and his family are unable to be with us today. I just want to express my thanks, and of course also I presume the association's thanks, for the work that he has done as our president for the past 2 years. As most of you know, he also served as editor of our journal for quite a few years as well. And we're not finished with him yet, because we do have another year of him on the executive board, because as you may know, the presidents serve really, although it's a term as president for 2 years, this is an explanation to some of the members that might not understand this, that there is first 1 year as first vice president, president-elect, and then another year following that, following their two-year term, as immediate past president. And they're on the executive board for all four of those years. So in a sense, we always have either an immediate past president or a president-elect on the board along with the president to help serve in either advisory capacities or fill-in capacities, like I did at the business meeting yesterday. I also have several other people that I think that we should thank, and I know that there are even more people to thank than these, but let me express this first. We've had three very enjoyable days, largely due to the efforts of several people. First of all, our program chairman and second vice president, Richard Perry. And in addition, we have, of course, local arrangements, and I believe the committee consisted of Don McCormick, Tom Owen, and David Hamilton. Before we get to tonight's main event, we do have a presentation that I would like to make to two people. Those of you who were at the business meeting yesterday know, of course, what I am going to be doing at this moment. But for those who were not there at the business meeting yesterday, let me give you the full explanation. Several months ago, back in December, the ARS board received a letter from our treasurer, Jerry Weber, who unfortunately also was not able to be here for the convention. And the letter reads as follows, basically. On the occasion of our annual conference at the Rodgers and Hammerstein's archive of the New York Public Library in New York next spring, it is inevitable that we will be aware of two ARSC members who have been closely associated with these institutions and have also made substantial contributions to the growth of ARSC. Philip Leeson Miller was largely responsible for the record collection which eventually formed the basis for the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound, as well as what is now the Lending Library of Records, which operates out of the same building at Lincoln Center, when he was at the Music Division of the New York Public Library, first under C.S. Smith from around 1935, then as its chief from 1959 until the 60s. He was involved with the establishment of ARSC and became its first president, 1966 to 1971. Among his other activities was his long-term connection with the American Record Guide as a record critic, particularly of Leader. In his retirement years, he has continued to be actively involved in ARSC. David Hall was the curator of Rodgers and Hammerstein for over 10 years. He has been involved in ARSC from the beginning and was the first editor of the journal, 1967 to 72, and vice president, president, and past president from 1979 to 1983. He was a leading member of the AAA committee, which accomplished ARSC's most elaborate enterprise to date, the Rigler and Deutsch Record Index. In view of the coincidence of ARSC's conference at the institution with which both were affiliated, it might be appropriate to recognize their contributions by conferring honorary membership on both of them. And yesterday at the executive board meeting, honorary membership was voted on by the membership on these two gentlemen. We don't, unfortunately, have certificates to hand to the two of them. Of course, David is not here. We will have certificates coming very shortly. But this is what, there may be one or two little changes, and it will be a very fancy calligraphy type of document, not the typescript that I have here now. There also will be a copy of it in the bulletin, which will be coming out shortly. But this is what the certificates will say. Honorary Membership, Association for Recorded Sound Collection. Whereas, David Hall has rendered notable service to the Association for Recorded Sound Collections as an officer and editor of its journal, and whereas he has advanced the art and science of sound recording as an industry leader for almost half a century, whereas he has contributed to the growth and enrichment of the history of recorded sound as curator of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives, New York Public Library, therefore be it resolved that David Hall be declared an honorary member of the association with all the rights and privileges of such membership as are indicated in Article 4, Section 5 of the bylaws. Voted and agreed by members assembled, New York City, April 18th, 1986. The other certificate reads as follows. Honorary Membership, Association for Recorded Sound Collections. Whereas Philip Leeson Miller has rendered notable service to the Association for Recorded Sound Collections as founding president and in other capacities, and whereas he has played a significant role in building the New York Public Library's collection of sound recordings and served as chief of its music division from 1959 to 1966, whereas he is one of the most distinguished American critics, therefore be it resolved that Philip Leeson Miller be declared an honorary member of the association with all the rights and privileges of such membership as are indicated in Article 4, Section 5 of the bylaws, voted and agreed by members assembled, New York City, April 18th, 1986. Would Phil please come forward? We don't have, as I said, a certificate, but I do have a presentation to make. Phil, you have been with us and with the recorded sound industry for such a long time. You have seen it grow from acoustical recordings to the Electrical 78 to the Microgroove record. And now I would like to present a little gift here. This is a compact disc Now, some of the people last night saw what this is. There's a picture of Edison on the front of this with the Washington machine, of course, but he is holding a compact disc. And there are recordings of Edison on here, and this is the label on this compact disc. And so this is a present to you as a token of the honorary membership. Would you like to say something?
There isn't very much I can say except thank you all. And, well, we do what we can.
I'm particularly glad to have been able to make these two presentations. When I joined the association in 1971, the very first conference I attended was here in New York City. When I first heard about the association several months before, I looked at the information and noticed that the president of the association at that time was Don Roberts, who was on the same campus as I was on at Northwestern University. And I also noticed David Hall and Philip Miller's name listed on the board of directors and in the journal. And I went to Don, who I had never met, even though he was just a quarter of a mile away in the music library, and I asked him, if I go to this conference, would I have a chance to meet David Hall and Philip Miller? And he said, yeah, certainly. And so I went and I joined, and the first afternoon, it was a thrill to be able to go along with a group of three or four other people, and we had lunch with David and Phil. That was my first official or unofficial ARSC luncheon. So from the very beginning, these two gentlemen have been an inspiration to me in doing research and work in recorded sound. Yes, Ray. Yes, that this would be a good point also.
I was reading one of the library magazines the other day and realized to my horror that I recognize one of the names in the obituaries. If you don't know, Don Levitt, who was also very intimately connected with the organization in its early days, passed away in the fall. Thanksgiving Day, yeah. Well, you can give more details than I can. It was a very, very short obit there. But Don was so intimately connected with the early stages of the organization, and as you know, he was head of the music division of the Library of Congress for many years. I think we should formally go on record expressing our condolences to the family, although belatedly.
Since you mentioned that, we have also lost another of our early, very important founding members. His name was brought up by Helen Roach several mornings ago. Here again, a lot of people have not yet heard that Milo Ryan passed away several months ago as well. Milo Ryan had founded the KIRO collection at the University of Washington, which is now in the National Archives, the author of the main catalog of that collection, History and Sound, and was the author of a very, very vitally important paper that was published in one of our first journals and was a talk that I believe was given at the 66 or 67 conference here. Here are the recordings, Where Are the Archivists? And this, as a matter of fact, was the topic of the original expressed intended main subject area of this conference that Richard Perry expressed, that sound recordings are artifacts and documents and need to be accorded the same, and we, of course, feel even more dignity as research tools. he tells the horror story in that article of a student who had written a paper about a historical event using the recordings of the event, of the speech in particular, that was the keynote of this particular event, and he failed. He was given a failing grade by that history professor because the documents that he used to support his paper were as a sound recording of the event rather than somebody's secondhand newspaper report or a written transcript of the speech. And yes, I definitely agree to the, if the tape didn't pick up the hiss. And this attitude was something which has really been in the forefront of the way our association is run, that the researchers, as well as the archivists, need to get together, that the researchers know that there are sound recordings that can be used, that the archivists know how to get the researchers involved with it, and that the academic community, as well as the public at large, give the respect due to these documents. Well, enough of the formal presentations. We have a speaker this evening, and to introduce this speaker, we will present David Hamilton.
Thank you, Michael. I've known our speaker of this evening for at least 15 years, but I've never, until this afternoon, had a chance to sit down with him and fill in the interstices of the biographies that I've read here and there, the reference works. And if I were to tell you everything I've heard, he wouldn't have any time left to speak. But I will try to fill out a few points that surprised me, that interested me, that I had not known, and that perhaps you don't know either. At the New England Conservatory, he studied composition with Warren Story Smith, and among his achievements in that area was an orchestral piece which he tells me did not win the prize that it was submitted for, but it did contain what he believes to have been, and I think from the date certainly was, the first fugato for percussion ever composed. He wrote his first reviews for the Boston Post, of which Warren Story Smith was the critic. And then from October 1926, he wrote for the Phonograph Monthly Review, a publication that came out of Boston. He wrote all the reviews, some of them under pseudonyms, so that it would look like a more populous publication than it was. And in 1930, he became the editor and publisher, and then was able to employ other writers, among them such distinguished names as Nicholas Slonimsky, Isaac Goldberg, and R.P. Blackmer. As early as 1927, he had reviewed jazz in this publication, which must be one of the first undertakings of that sort in such a publication, under the pseudonym of Rufus. And in 1932, after the Phonograph Monthly Review closed down, he came to New York, and for the New York Band Instrument Company, edited the Music Lover's Guide. Then he got involved, as some people from the New York Band Instrument Company did, with the gramophone shop. And there occurred something which I think he will tell us more about later. After that, he designed and edited the Gramophone Shop Supplement, and in 1939 received a Guggenheim Fellowship, and wrote a book which sounds like the book I've always wanted to write. I suggested that when he described it to me that it was a book about the impact of technology on musical life. And he agreed that that was really what it was about. He felt it didn't work out at the time, but he grasped very early something that's been concerning a lot of us ever since. He then went on to edit the Steinway Review of Permanent Music, which went through several metamorphoses, was briefly in the Signal Corps, and wrote manuals on electronics for training manuals for Hazeltine. Two further books, The Schirmer's Guide to Books and About Music and Musicians and Good Listening. Among his unique claims to uniqueness is that he's probably the only classical record reviewer that ever wrote for Downbeat. He wrote classical record reviews for them. And then he wrote an audio column for the Saturday Review, and where he encountered Roland Gillatt for the first time, and Roland invited him to come to High Fidelity in 1954 as a book reviewer. He's been with that publication ever since, which is a matter of more than 30 years. For most of those 30 years, he's written the tape deck column, and starting with a number of technical articles, has gone on to write music and record reviews. And if I were to characterize his writing about music briefly, because I've gone on too long already, but that's his fault because he's done so many things, I would say it's that his writing always conveys the sense that music is not only music, but it is part of a number of arts, and that all these arts are part of life, and that we really mustn't separate these things. And he's going to tell us about something that is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And I think I only need to hold it up and you can see the color and you know what I'm talking about. And it is I want to say something about that work that has always struck me as something special. It's one of the rare reference works that is personal, that it is not just a compilation, but it is, I suppose nowadays you'd call it user-friendly. But I prefer to think of it as humane. And with that thought, I'd like you to welcome R.D. Darrell.
Thank you. It's worthwhile being dragged out of my Catskill Cave hibernation to meet so many old and new friends. I just had a chance to autograph more copies of the encyclopedia tonight, two, than I have for years and years. I also made the mistake of bringing a copy, thinking very few might have ever seen one. Well, of course, Satchel Paige warned us about not looking back. But in recent years, as the anniversaries pile up, the temptation to do so has just become irresistible for me. And I find, indeed, that someone is catching up with me. It's a very unnerving doppelganger, the ghost of my own early self. And it's very disturbing when one is forced to relive the past. One of the costs, which is cheap enough when you consider the alternative, is going through a lot of the old agonies and some of the old pleasures. But some of the comparisons are very disturbing between then and now, especially when, by some absolutely unique happenstance, one's very first major achievement hit a jackpot that never again possibly could be matched. I'm like Rachmaninoff with his, the C-sharp minor prelude. I'm stuck. I have been, and I always will be, stuck with a triumph that was also a burden. The burden element wasn't evident at first, but
In 1952, when my work was completely superseded by the much greater work of Clough and Cummings, I incredulously read their opening remarks, the World's Encyclopedia, and it felt like reading my own epitaph, carved in stone. The principles and procedures of discography were laid down by R.D. Darrell in his Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia of Recorded Music, New York, 1936, and have been followed by subsequent compilers. The present work is planned on similar lines, and we must acknowledge what is indeed obvious, the inspiration and instruction we have derived from Darrell's work. And I just thought I was compiling a useful catalog resume, not bringing down the law from heaven. But being thus practically immortalized made me then, and still does, feel very ancient indeed. And I began following George Bernard Shaw's example of never starting a day's work until I'd gone through the Times' obituary columns and found my own name wasn't there. And my incurably quirky memory brings back dialogue of the period that just possibly may be pertinent. It was a record by the New Mayfair Orchestra for HMV, which was called In the Bushes at the Bottom of the Garden. And don't confuse that, of course, with B. Lilly's immortal, There Are Fairies in the Bottom of Our Garden. Here was a venerable Anglican vicar who had to be helped across a drain in the aforesaid garden bottom that had just been made by an even more superannuated rustic ditch digger. The vicar was apologetic. He said, once I could leap it with ease, but now Anno Domini creeps on apace. The ditch digger was sympathetic. Aye, they're creeping on me too, but I never knew the Latin name for them. Of course, every old-timer has a story of some sort, no matter how decrepit he may be, to tell. And since this is supposed to celebrate the 50th anniversary of my book, I'm primed to reveal all, or most all, about the now legendary Faded Blue volume, which I thought I'd have to bring along in case people hadn't seen it before. Who was crazy enough to hire me or anybody else to do a project like this? And how did I get started on it? It's questions like that that you never really hear about. And I hope we'll have time for perhaps some more questions of your own. But my story concerns an unsung hero, the real prime mover of the encyclopedia, a man by the name of William Tyler, Bill Tyler, who was probably the greatest record promoter and salesman that this country has ever seen. It was back in 1928 that he and his partner, Joe Brogan, who was the more conservative member of the pair, started the Gramophone Shop on a very small scale, but it soon became the mecca for imported as well as domestic records. In this country, they issued in 1929 and 1931 a pair of successive catalogs, normal catalogs of records that a dealer might carry, but boastfully they entitled them Encyclopedias of Recorded Music. My old friend and very able compiler Richard Gilbert got those out. But Tyler had more ambitious plans. And in the spring of 1934, he was planning possibly a hardcover book that would be a real encyclopedia. And now why he didn't get Dick Gilbert, I don't know. I think perhaps by that time, Gilbert was managing the record department at Delius Records, but there are know of such and such Delius records, but there are other things, and name these other things that should be done. And when I went to the Music Lover's Guide, I did all the reviews. This was like the gramophones, our staff reviewers. I was our staff. The articles, however, were what we'd now call specialized discographies on a small scale. As I'd have recorded symphonies, recorded quartets, recorded concertos, recorded Elizabethan music, recorded American composers, and that sort of thing. So when Tyler hired me to get out this bigger book, although he didn't realize then how big it was going to be, I had that nucleus to work with. And plus that, I had all the back files of the gramophone, the Phonograph Monthly Review, Music Lover's Guide, the two-disc magazine, small D in Philadelphia and large D in Paris, and the gramophone shop's own monthly bulletins and new releases as they came in. And to these, I got Tyler to order two copies for clipping purposes of every worldwide record manufacturer we could find out about. And those turned out to be very useful in many cases because one of the entries of a record that was put out by various affiliated companies would have more information than another. The Italian HMV might have more on an opera. The British HMV usually had more on almost everything. But the handicap was that I lacked the tools that are so normal today. We didn't have Einstein's revision of Kerschel. We didn't have the Schmieder Bach. We didn't have the Deutsch Schubert, Hoboken, or Robertsland and Haydn, no Berghauser Dvorak, no Kirkpatrick Scarlatti, no Pachelle or Riom Vivaldi. Only the third edition of Groves and the fourth edition of Baker, both lacking Slemsky's later date corrections. We didn't even have that blacklist of musical counterfeits, the incomparable Ye Old Spuriosity Shop, or Put It in the Anhang by Charles Cudworth. And incidentally, if Notes doesn't reprint that one of these days, I think the journal of this society should. The full dimensions of the project I was working on soon became apparent and were really quite terrifying. It meant an awful lot of work. I did work something over 2 years on it. But Tyler already had been warned by one of his best customers, who was also a publisher, Alfred A. Knopf, who was a great record collector and musical connoisseur. Knopf said, "Well, I'd gladly pay $50 or some then such preposterous price for such a book, but I wouldn't dream of publishing it." And he was quite right, of course. It never was a commercial success except for the gramophone shop's own business. And I warned him that keep up with what I'd started, it was going to take quite a lot of time and trouble. But he went ahead anyway. He wanted to do it. And Brogan, the conservative man, probably had a good many qualms about it, but Tyler never once told me, warned me to hurry up or to reduce the scale that the thing was assuming. What he worried about was getting some kind of musical respectability for the book, which he thought could only be obtained by the imprimatur of Lawrence Gilman, who was the supreme musical authority of the time and the place. And I didn't need any hint to know that the way to Gilman's heart was through Debussy, Mussorgsky, and above all, Wagner. And so that's why those particular entries I've done with such great detail. It pleased Gilman. And sure enough, it worked. When we showed Gilman the typescript of those entries, he was very glad to provide this sanctioning foreword. Of course, I regret now a good deal more than I did then that I couldn't have treated every important composer with as much care and detail, but of course that simply wasn't practical. What I worried most about, apart from trying to find every record that was then available and somehow identifying the musical contents, which was very difficult at times, was the typographical scheme. Because I have the notion that no reference book is ever read in the normal sense. It's searched. You look through it for whatever you want. And if you can arrange the type in such a way that in the order of precedence you're likely to go through it, it'll speed, your eye will speed your mind a great deal and make it much easier to find things. But I was lucky in that that time the printers, it was the tag end of the Depression, and printers were so anxious for a job of this sort that they were willing to set up a lot of sample pages so I could experiment, fool around till I really could find exactly what I wanted. But in the event, when the book finally came out, that typographical choice of typography and the arrangement and so on was one of the last things that most reviewers ever noticed. Clough of Clough and Cummings did later on, I know. But even Lewis Foreman, when he did his book on systematic discography and wrote a lot about my book and was running an illustration of my typography, by mistake picked a later edition by Bob Reed, which was all right in its way, but it wasn't mine. That's one of the two great ironies about the final realization of the whole project was that in the event this typographical scheme of mine I'd worked so hard on, so long on, was passed over almost in silence. On the other hand, the feature that I gave the least attention to and thought so little of, I left it to the last and hadn't planned it at all at the beginning with a little introductory notes to the various composers. I found that some of the entries, like Wagner, where I'd accounted for practically every bar that had been recorded and wasn't recorded, they needed some special explanation before you went through the entries. And other composers I knew would be obscure or unknown to most Americans. So I felt that there's some kind of a little note, partly biographical, partly mostly to place the men in time and space, were necessary. So for consistency's sake, I used them for everybody. And of course, this thing I'd done at the last moment and thought least of turned out to be the feature of the book that almost every reviewer commented on at considerable length. And a great many reader correspondents since that time have told me that was the way they started their musical education. Even the great librarian here in New York, Mary Lawton, in her entry on dictionaries of music in the Thompson International Encyclopedia, singled out these things as typical of the new kind of dictionary in helping people who might not read a biography by themselves would still get some notion about the composers whose work they really, really enjoyed. So that's so much for what one thinks one's doing and as contrasted with what other people take to be what was done. But at the time, I was brash enough, I think, to give the impression of knowing what I was doing, even when I didn't. And so I enjoyed a most remarkable freedom of action. I was unlucky that I had no editor to correct my errors or give me advice. I had no model to follow. There was nothing that would give me any help. There hadn't been anything like that. There'd been some specialized discographies, but nothing on this scale. And things of this sort have become practically impossible nowadays in the present day of of committees and consensus, as David said, there was something personal about my Baba. It was a one-man job, and those things are, I'm afraid, a thing of the past. Our own Kurtz Myers, in his notes record ratings, probably is one of the very few exceptions today. And probably Kurtz and I are the only people who can fully appreciate Haydn's tribute to the independence he enjoyed at Esterhazy. Perhaps you remember, it's often quoted. "I could make experiments, observe what produced an effect and what weakened it, and was thus in a position to improve, alter, make additions or omissions, and be as bold as I pleased. I was cut off from the world. There was no one to confuse or torment me, and I was forced to become original." It's a very heady experience, I can tell you that. But, of course, while I was working there, there were times when it seemed to be a really impossible dream that I ever would finish it. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, times in an absolute sweat of terror, of a nightmare of falling sick or being in an accident, anything that would incapacitate me. Who the hell would ever be able to pick up this mess of stuff I had around and bring it into the form that I had in mind? But it did come to pass finally. Around the 1st of July, I believe, the first printed copies of the book appeared, nearly simultaneously, by the way, with one of the pioneering specialized biographies at the time, Julian Martin Moses, I believe spoke here earlier, his famous Record Collector's Guide to Columbia and Victor Acoustical Celebrity Records from the first issue, I think, was just from 1903, 1912. He extended that later on. And the reviews of my book came in, both from here and abroad, and were absolutely unbelievable. I've got too well developed an ego to be overly modest, but I know very well that the extravagant reception of the encyclopedia could only be explained by larger considerations than my own contributions, no matter valuable or not, as they may have been. The intensity of the cumulative need for such a book, the perfect timing of its appearance in 1936, is impressively massed evidence of the then generally unsuspected scope of the existing recorded repertory, and possibly, I hope, I'd like to think anyway, the infection of my own undisguised personal enthusiasm. All these had to combine to win for so unprecedented a venture, so unprecedented a reception. It's unbelievable. It was absolutely uncritical. Because among the passionate discophiles and record reviewers of the time, the joy of having at long last a comprehensive survey of their realm was so extreme that many of them simply abandoned their usual sobriety and sense of restraint. The veteran British gramophone critic, W.R. Anderson, for instance, uncharacteristically exclaimed, "I don't know what high honors America has to confer, but I'd bid up to the vice presidency for Mr. Darrell." You see, poor Mr. Anderson didn't know America too well, although he'd visited here and he collaborated with Howard D. McKinney at Rutgers on some fine history appreciation books, but he wasn't familiar with what FDR's vice president, Jack Gardner, thought of the office. The way I heard it, probably expurgated, is not worth a bucket of warm spit. But incidentally, I even brought this long case. It sounds unbelievable, and it is. But this was a full-page review in the gramophone, which began with that quoted remark. Another British veteran, W. McNaught, writing in the Musical Times, was a little more restrained. "Mr. R.D. Darrell, who must be a quick worker to have got through the job in one lifetime, deserves more reward than he will get in this world," which is true enough, "for his patience and thoroughness, for his initiative in a system that fits his material. His system, in fact, takes 6 pages to explain, and none of the provisions so fully and therefore so clearly set forth is unnecessary. And even the formidable Alfred Frankenstein out in San Francisco went absolutely hyperbolical. A Herculean job, a work of scholarship and a labor of love, is by no means an exaggeration to say that Darrell has done for his restricted field what Groves does for all music, or what Cobbett's Cyclopedic Survey of Chamber Music does for its particular territory. Can you believe any of that? Of course, that was pretty heady stuff for a youngster at the time, and I must admit that at times I succumbed to the Jack Horner syndrome. The very first time I put in my thumb and pulled out a plum, I had to think, what a bright boy am I. But it was only later that I discovered that this was a very disheartening truth, that those things, that a freak success like that is the rarest thing in the world. I believe that I worked harder, planned more imaginatively, and organized my materials better in my later Shermer's Guide to Books on Music and Musicians and the book Good Listening, the early 50s. But while these were favorably enough received, they never even began to get the ecstatic reception. For instance, there were nearly full-page newspaper, full newspaper page reviews in a Dutch newspaper and in a Japanese newspaper, which I, fortunately, perhaps I couldn't read. I'd learned, though, to my sorrow, that hard work is no substitute for a gimmick. And there's no gimmick, no gimmicks are more potent than priority, timeliness, and just sheer good luck. Few explorers have had the good fortune of finding a promised land, New World, on their first pioneering voyage. But while I lay no claim to be a founding father of the art and science of discography, paternity in these cases is rather too hard to establish, I am very proud to have been, as it were, present at the creation, and to have had the good sense to retire promptly on whatever discographic laurels I may have won, fairly or unfairly. Pioneers are notoriously poor colonizers. But there's no lack of colonizers. You had, I believe, one here earlier, Bob Reed, who edited the third edition, the 1948 edition, and did a good job on his own without departing from my plans and writing his own notes, in contrast to the fiasco of the 42 edition, which was not only a botched job, but a plagiaristic one. My scheme and my introductory notes were cribbed all the way without a word of acknowledgement, which would help take me down a peg, of course. But I came across a note by Fernand Braudel in the preface to his great Mediterranean and the Mediterranean World in the Age of Philip II, where he's speaking just about this same kind of colonization. Any work of synthesis inspires a new crop of specialized research, and such research did not fail to follow in the wake of my book. It began by following my footsteps, and now has completely overwhelmed me. I could agree with that. Such subsequent work is just what this society and other discographers are so impressively piling up nowadays. In saluting it with the liveliest admiration and perhaps just a trace of envy, I still am very glad that I did my stint once and for all long ago. And in my beginning is my end. For I can look back now, not without pride, to the time long ago when I was given the rare and precious privilege to speak out for the early discophiles, to pioneer in mapping and exploring their new world, and to give them, in my encyclopedia's epigraph, a still unmatched expression of the joys and rewards of record listening, Thomas Manns in his Magic Mountain, where Hans Castorp discovers a world to conquer, large enough that even to survey it was a difficult task at first and bewildering, yet a world of beautiful possibilities, all imaginable music, the happiest inspirations from every region of the art. Hans Castorp's thoughts, or rather his prophetic half-thoughts, soared high as he sat there in night and silence before his truncated sarcophagus of music, They soared higher than his understanding. They were alchemistically enhanced. And so may ours always be. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're embarrassing me.
We want to take some questions. David, would you want to field the questions? I could also, but while I'm standing here, I would like, on behalf of the association, to present you also with a gift of one of these Edison compact discs.
Thank God I didn't have to include them.
Mort? Mortimer Fang?
Anyone who undertakes the kind of project that you undertook is always leaving himself open to criticism. And I'm just curious, since you haven't mentioned it, did you get much flack from many people, indeed many people, about things that you omitted?
No. No. Surprisingly enough, I didn't. There were many faults with the encyclopedia, but I don't think there were many major omissions.
Terry?
I don't want to ask a question. I just want to say thank you. I just want to make the observation that when I was 19 years old, I stumbled into a Bryn Mawr book sale in Princeton, New Jersey. I don't know who the critic was, but his entire collection, including a battered copy of the Gramophone Encyclopedia of 1936, was in that sale. I made an offer for the whole kit and caboodle and then took it. I have used that copy of the Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia of 1936 as a reference book as a Bach and Handel collector ever since. I have yet to find a mistake. God bless you all.
Oh, no. Look again, look again. The one mistake that I'm really ashamed of, a lot of the things, the spellings and so on, hadn't been and dates hadn't been as settled now as they were after Slonimsky's work. I killed off poor old Oscar Strauss a good many years before his actual death. But the worst thing was those mistakes I could say with Dr. Johnson, ignorance, madam, sheer ignorance. But another one I knew better. I cataloged Vaughan Williams under Williams. Why, I'll never know.
Yes.
During the late 1950s and early 1960s, when you were writing your columns for High Fidelity magazine, you reviewed a lot of the open reel tapes at that time. A lot of people feel that that was sort of the golden age of recording. How do you feel that the current recordings compare with the recordings that you were reviewing in general at that time?
My opinion is that a good recording remains a good recording forever. I've heard some of the old acoustics. I've heard some early electrics. There are a great many early stereos, which, by the way, were sort of accidentally done. The famous Reiner Zarathustra, by the way, was not done by the regular, Lou Layton, I think, the regular engineer. They had a second or third rate engineer up in the, up in the third balcony and making an experimental stereo recording, and that was the great stereo Zarathustra. Techniques change some, but it's incremental, really, the progress, as far as I'm concerned.
Rich? Rich Marker?
I'd like to say I've heard of your book, but this is the first night I've had a chance to see it, thanks to Mark Reiner. And I noticed that you listed Duke Ellington, which must be one of the very first considerations of Ellington as a serious composer. And I'd like to know, was this a pretty daring move at the time, and what was the response to it?
There was wasn't daring at all. I began reviewing as Rufus. I was redheaded in those days. All the works that came in, and among them was a record by someone I'd never heard of before, the Washingtonians, playing black and tan fantasy, and when I heard that, I was transported. And then later on, I did the article on Ellington, which was the first serious article on him. Well, it was the West. What was the Western Cuneo Company? Chicago Cuneo Press. Well, they really did a wonderful job. Except that I had great regrets because this fellow from Baltimore had been so kind in setting up sample pages for me, enabled me to devise the typographical scheme I finally settled on.
John Francis.
You made another mistake tonight.
Yes. I think they did.
Well, for this reason, that assuming that their audience would have copies already, they gave much less full and numerous listings.
Yeah, that is true. I'd forgotten that. Of course, the scope was so much more immense. They covered so much more ground.
Right. The collectors who have the World's Encyclopedia, the Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia too, the 1936 version,
the one and original.
Yes. What was the press run of the book?
That is a question I expected to get, and I hunted all over. I don't know. But the impression I had was 6,500. I know we got 2,000 copies pre-publication sales, and a year or two after that, we'd sold about 5,000 of them. Then it dragged on. By Bob Reed's 48 encyclopedia, they still were advertising some remaining copies.
Yes, I bought one from the Gramophone Shop.
So it never possibly could have paid the printing costs or my very modest salary at the time, but it did put the Gramophone Shop, and to some extent me, on the map.
Six thousand five hundred.
And at the advance of publication price was only $2. The regular copy was $3.50. Imagine that.
Any more? Don McCormick.
Can I come up for a minute? Okay.
This is the reference desk copy of the first edition of the Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia that we have in the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives. Okay, 1936. It's got four strips of binding on the spine. The spine is broken, etc., etc. This is the copy we still keep using for reference work and everything. And I would like you, Mr. Darrell, please, to autograph the title page for us, okay?
For the reference division.
Just Hammerstein Archives. First printing too, okay.
Sure to change your catalog and put that as a number on it.
Thank you very much.
There are more copies of the book in this room tonight than there have been in any one place.
I think that's absolutely true.
Except in the Gramophone Shop itself.
Well, maybe not.
I had one further observation, thinking about your remark about the design not being mentioned. I think perhaps that's the ultimate compliment to the design, that people would have complained about it if it hadn't been satisfactory, but that in fact it is very easy on the eye. It leads you directly to the information.
That's a very nice thought.
I think that's why nobody ever said anything about it.
Never occurred to me before.
Are there any more questions? I think you now have some books to autograph. Thank you very much.